One of the topic, well, the main topic of discussion today for us has been the past, the present, and the future impact of scholarly journals on research. And so I kind of want to focus on what I think is maybe the future impact of journals on research. And I'm going to kind of focus on an area that I think, from my perspective, as someone who works in the field of metrics and network analytics, what I think will make, either at the article level or the journal level, this is one of the most exciting times, I think, in scholarly communication. Because of the sort of digital revolution that we've gone into, we have lots of all this other material, this data material out there, that'll allow us to solve some of the big problems that we're having in terms of navigation and figuring out attribution and all these sorts of things. So I purposely labeled it article level navigators, even though this is a journal sort of discussion, but you'll see sort of later on why I'm focused more on that and why this could easily just be journal level navigators. So this is kind of a play off of the area of altmetrics. So for those that are familiar with the altmetrics movement, they call them article level metrics. I'm sort of calling this article level navigators, and you'll see why in just a second. So this is one of the big questions I have as a researcher all the time. I want to know what journals should I read, because there's lots and lots of them, and which journal should I publish in. These are questions that I ask myself almost on a daily basis, especially when we're collaborating, when we get to that point where we're trying to decide where we should disseminate the finding that we have. So if you'll let me, I'm going to really oversimplify how you would go about answering that question. One of the ways, is to simply look at whatever the influence. This could be any sort of impact metric. It could be the number of downloads on a journal. It could be the number of citations. It could be the impact factor. It could be the ID factor. It could be any of these sorts of things. But if I'm comparing two journals, let's say one journal, hitting the wrong arrow, one journal that has, you know, some amount of influence in the community of research that I'm interested in, and then you have another journal. And again, if you allow me to simplify it, it makes for an easy decision for me. I want to read the journal that is higher up the scale, and I also want to publish in this scale that I provided you. But as we all know, there's lots of other dimensions that make this sort of question a lot more complicated than this. Let me give you an example. So one example is consideration of field. So if I'm in the field of ophthalmology, for example, and I don't really necessarily care what the highest impact journal or the highest influential journal is in communications. I care about my field. So there are other dimensions in this space that I'm talking about. But one dimension that I think is ignored, has been ignored for some time, but I don't think it's going to be ignored anymore, especially with the movement of open access. And that is the dimension of price. Now price, this doesn't necessarily have to be in an open access journal. And what I'll do now is I'll just kind of simplify it. And I'll do the same sort of thing I did with the y-axis there on influence. If I have two journals, and if they have exactly the same influence, but one is more expensive than the other, are these journals the same? And that's kind of the question I want to ask you to start the discussion I want to have. Are these journals different? And I'll argue that I think they are different. And if they have the same impact, if there is such a thing, then you would choose the journal that's of less price than the other. So what I want to do now is extend that and say, okay, let's allow me to again keep simple, oversimplifying this, but anything above if this is the journal that you're publishing in currently, this little dot here, and someone was to give you some choices of journals in a quadrant above that one, regardless of price, I would imagine that you would choose something there. You're wrong button. I'm just gonna hit the space bar. Okay, then again, in this case, you would choose journals in the upper quadrant. And we can do the same sort of thing for price again. So if you are looking for a journal and you pay a particular price and someone says, hey, I can give you the same journal at the same influence, but it's much cheaper, would you choose that? Maybe so if you're a scientist early in your career and the price is $1,500 versus $5,000. Believe it or not, quite all this data, and there are journals that are not expensive to pay. But now, let me go ahead and take this a step further. So, if you're interested in you've been publishing, let's say, for the last, most of your career
in this on this particular journal that has this particular influence and this particular price. And as we know, if you look at the charts, there's over 30,000 journals, and this sort of thing is probably not going to stop growing. There's more and more to choose from. In this case, this quadrant is the especially good quadrant because it's cheaper and it's more influential. Any journal that exists in that quadrant. Now, this is, I say not as good because if I said bad, there are other factors, but I'll keep saying not as good. This quadrant is more expensive and also cheaper. So what about these other quadrants? Are they good or are they bad? Well, that depends. It depends on what economists call your indifference curve. If you are in a lab that doesn't have as much money, and you need to pay that price or anything less, you're okay with moving down into that quadrant. It's not necessarily a bad or good quadrant. These quadrants aren't necessarily bad or good. This quadrant, on the other hand, maybe for a lab that has plenty of money but wants more influence. So those quadrants don't matter. The colors aren't coming out really well. But the dependence quadrants are what matters. So one of the things that my colleagues and I did, because it just wasn't there, this market that seems to be brewing, especially the open access market that's brewing, we're getting hundreds of new journals, not on a monthly basis, but we're getting a large number of journals all the time. And so scholars, especially in third world countries, I've talked to a lot of groups from China, and they're required, as you know, to go publish in Western journals. It's a lot easier for us when we in the Western areas to see, okay, we don't even almost need a tool, although it's becoming overwhelming already for those that are familiar with these particular journals, to decide which journal should I publish in, of course, which one should I read. So what we did is we scraped all of the prices that we could find for open access and used a lot of other available databases, the prices and the influence. And this is sort of one of the initial graphs. And you can select, and I'll show you in just a second, a tool for figuring out which journals, if you have a choice, should you consider as well if you're looking for open access journals. And this, again, is targeted to any researcher, but it's targeted especially for those that aren't familiar with your field. You can select by field. So let me just quickly, I'll show you a few ways in which you can play with this. So what it does is it populates this with all of the journals within a particular field. So if you're in life sciences and you've been publishing in BMC, you can start to see with the crosshairs all the other journals. If this particular, so this particular journal I just selected is Diagnostic Pathology. It's a journal published by BMC, and it costs $1,625 and has a particular influence. In this case, we use article influence, which is one of our eigenfactor metrics, which is basically the eigenfactor normalized by the size of that journal. And this gives you an idea of those journals that are less expensive and of higher influence. So what we're trying to do, the goal of this, was to create a more transparent market. If we create a more transparent market, it's not bad to necessarily be expensive if you're providing a huge amount of value and you're providing a lot of influence. And if you're not, why do we have journals? And actually, if you see the original data, it's one big sort of shotgun. There's no demand curve that you see that's formed yet. And you find journals. I don't label Owen Kisser as an editor here on some of these. But they're a lot more expensive for the given price. So you can, actually, we're doing a major update right now on the data. And what's really interesting, the most interesting thing for me as a scholar, is to see whether the journals will start responding. And I will say this, within 6 weeks of putting this up, might even have been less, I should look at my emails. I had several emails from publishers that asked to update their new price that they had just updated. So that was one of the most big celebration that day in the lab. I'm not saying necessarily we had done that, but they were letting us know that they were updating their price. And to follow, we did update their price. So we did a big major update, actually, with the help of a student, MLIS student in the information school, that redid all these prices, and we put these up new, and we'll have some results. So the question is it gonna happen over time that we get something like this? And if we get something like this, this is good for, I have a plan, this is good for the journal market, it's good for scholarly communication. We know that not all prices are the same, we know all novel research is the same. We need a tool like this. So this leads me to sort of the general question I'm interested in, which is article-level metrics. And I call them alternative article level metrics because there's a semantic argument to every one of these conferences on the all metrics. So I'm just going to use all of the words that are in here. But there's lots of things in all metrics that people talk about. The most common ones, of course, are my dislike paper being noted on Twitter or on Facebook. And I'm glad. I want people to keep working on that. I think it will. These will continue to be used. But I'm working sort of, my colleagues and I are thinking a lot about other kinds of metrics that we think will be effective, will be important for placing next to journals and also articles. And one of them was cost effectiveness, like I just showed you there. But there's a whole series of others. And this is just a couple examples. I have about six or seven others that we're working on that we think are there not only for the author, so when they go to a tenure promotion committee, they can have ways of promoting their content, but also, most importantly, in my opinion, for the reader. One of the things that the Allmetrics, I think, movement forgets to address is, are we doing these things for the reader or the author? And I like to make the argument that I think what we the main target should be the reader, and then doing things for the author is also important. So that's sort of one of the big questions in my lab and my research group. We think about ways in which we can take these large data sets, in this case, the citation networks and all the other metadata associated with these large corpora that are now becoming available for researchers like myself, to move from just the metric aspect of it, which was the beginning of the Item Factor project, to navigating, which I find is, to me, the part that I really want to spend most of my time thinking about. So it's moving from measuring things, and we need that measuring aspect of bibliometrics, scientometrics, and we need to go, and I want to see us all move to prospecting. And in this case, at the article level, but this is where journals can help as well. So I'm going to give a couple examples to kind of end off the talk with some areas in which, to give you some examples of what I mean by an article level navigation. So there's some, one of the things you can do with these metrics is not just place them on your website as a journal publisher or as an archive, but you can do things like filtering, you can do things like mapping, you can do recommendations, prospecting, and pivoting. And that's the sort of things that we're working on with lots of groups, including Microsoft Academic Search, SSRN, JSTOR, lots of these groups that are interested in pushing this area as much as we are. So for those that know about Eigenfactor, it doesn't really show up well, I'm not going to go over the details of it. I'm going to show you a couple updates of things on the Eigenfactor project. I mean, this is just one schematic of distinguishing between sort of more of the traditional metrics like impact factor and metrics like Eigenfactor that take into account the full network. You can't really see with the colors that well, but the difference between a network-based metric and a metric that we call degree centrality metrics, the biggest difference is that the network metrics are taking into account the full structure of the network. And we claim, just like many algorithms that do this sort of thing, like PageRank, that there's a lot of value in the topologies of these networks. And so we have a website. All the stuff that we build is free for this sort of thing. You'll find the metrics, of course, in the JCR, and they're doing some major changes, and we can talk about that in sort of another talk. But I do want to do a quick experiment with you, because I need to collect as much usage data as possible. And I didn't get IRB support to do this, so I won't collect it, but I'll just see for fun. So for those that have heard of the Eigenfactor metric, this is a network-based metric, one of the ways for interpreting what it is to think of randomly walking around the library from one journal citation to another for a very, very long time. Very, very long time. At the end of it, you then report back to me how long you spent in each one of those networks. That's one way of interpreting it. And the numbers can be interpreted as the percentage of time that you spent in each one of those journals. So this is one area, this is sort of my area, ecology and evolution, that I was trained in, and so I know these journals very well. That means that out of all 10,000 journals in this particular corpus and the tens of millions of citations, you would have spent at the Proceedings of the Royal Society 0.09% of the time at that particular journal. So that's the interpretation that we've been using for a long time. But there's another way of interpreting it. It's the exact same metric. There's no change in the ordinal ranking. And this is how you interpret it. It's the exact same thing. So the order is exactly the same. There's just a slightly different normalization. And we're actually talking with several groups that are collecting usage data for us to see if people interpret these numbers differently. Because we've found, like many would expect, that if you put 0.00 or any sort of point in the numbers after that, people don't like that. And it's just they're not comfortable with that. It's too hard to interpret.
So we've taken it seriously,
and this is what it is now. It's the exact same thing. So now you see 9.93.
9.93 can be interpreted this way. It means that that particular journal is 9.93 times as influential as the mean
journal in the full corpus.
So I'll repeat it again just because I said it fast.
It's 9.93 as influential as the mean journal in all the field. So you can just read down there, and if you see a 5, you're like, well, that's 5 times as influential as all of them in the field.
So, as if we're raising a hand who kind of has at least heard of iVector and thought out a little bit, and wasn't quite as clear, do you like option A, the random walk interpretation, or do you like the multiple? Okay, so I'll do raise a hand, who likes A? Oh, there are a few, okay, because that's the one I like, but no, usually that's not the case. Okay, there are a few, thank you. Made sure that. Okay, who likes B? Okay, all right, it's pretty solid. Okay, so if you guys can sign the IRB release form up there, put that in the paper. No, we're actually working on this, and we're finding it, I won't get into these little details, but these sorts of things are really important. So we're using, again, these metrics to do actual filtering. So I'm working with a guy named Jeff Davis at Google, where we built a web browser platform extension that allows you to go places like PubMed, for example, and you'll hit a search, and it'll immediately look for all the journals, and now all the articles as well, and immediately filter them by column. Because we're getting so massively hit with so many results at these portals that we built in the plugin, you just put it into your web browser, and you go to these portals, and it colorizes them, and we show you the distribution of what the colors mean. And we've got a lot of feedback, and I'm actually using it all the time. Now I find it incredibly useful for filtering. So this is one example of filtering. We're working with plots, and this is an example. One example, so what PLOS did was they gave us their citation network, and what we did was take their graph and output, this is an actual PLOS site, this is just you can search any article in PLOS, and at the bottom, it looks at the sometimes 30 or 40 references, and the algorithm, using the iVector algorithm, goes through and filters, and this, the color scheme isn't so good at this point, we're still working on this, but it'll filter based on, it highlights based on what you want it to filter for you. In this case, these are the classic papers in the field. So if you're a graduate student, and you're new to a field, and you just were given this paper from your advisor, and there were 80 references on it, it'll give you at least a clue. Now these algorithms don't always get it right, but this is one way, and we're working with PLOS, and they look, after quality assurance, they may start incorporating this into their lab. So, I know people are getting tired. It's been a good but long day. So this is sort of the a point that I want to make about all of this, that we have these article level metrics that we now can collect on all of this data that we didn't have even 10 years ago. We put it into what I'm calling these article level navigators, the filtering algorithms, the recommendations, all these sorts of things, so that we can discover things faster. But what's going to happen is that's going to then affect the ALMs. And I actually think this is a good thing. These are the sorts of things we're trying to model to understand better. So again, I went through this list. Here's a couple other things. There's also recommendation engines that we're spending a lot of time thinking about, using the same iVector technology that we used in developing the metrics for, again, improving the discoverability of material within this sea of papers that's being thrown at the community every single day. I mean, PLOS, for example, what they publish, just PLOS one itself, like 200 papers a day or more than that. Oh yeah, it is up there, I already put that up there. and then we're working with SSRN, actually collecting data on that. So they're one of the big things when I was starting to enter the field, I heard of lots of different algorithms for doing recommendation, but I wanted to actually see what the users thought. So what we have set up, with the help of Ralph Dandria and the folks at SSRN, we set up a true A/B system that scholars can start to use. We know that Google has them, we know that Microsoft has them for Bing and for Google search engine and all these, but we wanted to set one up for scholars that you can put in a recommendation, like iVector recommends, and then you can test it against thousands and thousands and thousands of users. And the way we test it is we simply say, we provide the recognition, do they follow the link, but most importantly, do they then download the paper? And then it gets a hit. We collect thousands and thousands and thousands of those. And what we found, we did a random trial where we gave just a bunch of junk recommendations that are just random in the network, have nothing to do with community, the community that you're looking in. And essentially, it was almost 0% click-through. which really surprised me. I thought we at least had a little bit of time. We're still running these actively. We also did the typical, most common one is collaborative filtering. That's the sort of thing you see at Amazon. At Amazon, you do, if I've read this book and someone else have read this book, then they look at our common libraries. That's collaborative filtering. We had about 1.31% hit-through rate. Now, the Eigenfactor recommends uses the network. It's the network approach. I won't go into details. It's not that I've made full talks just on that. And what we have found so far, approximately, again, it fluctuates. The confidence bars aren't exactly at 3.26, but the results are very strong towards the impact of Eigenfactor agreements. And that may change as we collect more data, we test different kinds of disciplines, et cetera. But so far, the big thing is we have the system so we can actually test them and, again, move from just measuring things to navigating. So the other thing is prospective work. And so this was I won't go into details as much on these sort of things, but prospective, what I mean by that is taking what we know about the network so far, like co-authorship networks, and try to predict the value of an article that just came out today in New York Times, or that was reported in New York Times. What sort of information can I glean? There's all sorts of metrics that you can do things on there. And also pivoting. And pivoting is something that I think is going to be dependent on being able to auto-categorize. And this is something we're working with Microsoft Academic Search. Actually, Alex Wade is here. And we're trying to do, we're trying to allow the content itself, the links in the network, tell us what the groups. And those groups are changing dramatically. And we can take advantage of that. Computers are pretty smart. We use machine learning techniques to try again and helping people pivot quicker as the content changes. So in summary, these are the sorts of things I think about. How do we use all of these article-level metrics that we're collecting at the journal level and at the article level and turn them into better discoverability? And so I want to end with this following question. A lot of people ask me this from my perspective working on the Eigenfactor project. Will journals survive in a strongly article-level market right now? And actually, I think they will. And it kind of goes back to one of the comments that there was about the Pink Floyd album. As a researcher, I am willing to buy that Pink Floyd album, and I think there are a lot of things that the journals can provide. I think one of the more important ones is all of this metadata that they're collecting. And I think that's where the journals will survive and also provide a lot of value to researchers. But one of the things I think that they need to recognize is there's a difference between author needs and reader needs. And when you look at something like a class, for example, the top part is kind of more directed towards authors, although it can still be used by the readers. But to me, I think the real exciting areas are what we can do for the readers. So all of this stuff, of course, lots of people are working on. These are just some of the people actually in this room. And I will stop there.
Pattern through there, and maybe get rid of some of the more anomalous things. could you actually, you can assign countries?
Yes, yes, so we have that data, yes.
Okay, because that would be very, very interesting, because there is a trend there that, that people in developing countries are responding to the market as it exists right now. And if you could do a differentiation between different countries, that would actually be very unique information for people in the international studies thinking about knowledge transfer and all that. That's,
I think it's an excellent question, and actually I have the data, and if you want to, we can look at it afterwards and just see. This is, a lot of this is new, and actually the cool part is the new update that took us a little while. We need somehow to get funding so it can be done each year now, because we want to respond to these journals when they make adjustments, or you don't really have this adaptable market that we want to happen. But I think this would be incredibly interesting, and we do have countries attached to them. I remember that that's a column we for sure included in the data. So let's go ahead and look at that. I actually don't know the answer, but I can see that. And by the way, the trend that you're mentioning, there is a slight trend. The original one, this is the second rendition. The third rendition of the data is even a little bit tighter. There's some areas it's a little looser. But in this case, there is somewhat of a relationship. There's nothing. I shouldn't say there's a complete shotgun approach, but there is a slight. But anyway, that's a great question. Let's look at that. I said I'd take care of it, we'll go through. Yes.
Here's the last point you made about the tool for auto categorization.
Yes.
Just, I don't know how much you can say about it, but I'm curious how it would work.
Yes.
Is it something where, in order for the tool to pick up on the different journals, you have to have the same keywords built in, so you'd essentially be limiting your vocabulary to certain words, or can it actually parse through the text and understand, oh, well, you know, this person in England who's writing a little bit different style than the American is actually talking about the same thing.
So, excellent question, and actually I would have paid for that question because this is where I get to talk a little bit about the methods. But our particular method is a little, it's almost orthogonal to what natural language processors do and most of the people in linguistics. We actually, the results of the auto-categorization algorithm that we put in doesn't even look at any text. It looks only at the relationships of the documents. And of course, if you look at millions and millions and millions of articles and relationships, you can get many of the same sorts of things that you would get in text. But we would claim this is sort of our philosophical stance on the matter. We think this even gives you more information. That if you only look at the relationships, you don't get clouded by all the noises in the semantics. Now, we use the semantics to do the title groups, and that's a really hard problem. But that's the only part where there's some kind of the grouping parts. That's where I think we are very confident in the kinds of results that we can get. And we can do it hierarchically, too. So when we do this clustering, it's not just saying, here's biology, here's economics, and here's sociology. It does this hierarchically. And I can show you some examples. You can go back and show some things where we've done this hierarchically, and what we really want to do is do this over time, and actually we are doing this sort of thing, not just in the scholarly world, but we're doing it on things like Wikipedia and looking at how this auto-categorization technique matches up with what humans have curated as the field of macroeconomics. So anyway, I'd love to talk more about it, but just the one note I want to say is that it doesn't look at text at all until it starts meaning labels. Yes?
Yeah, I'm really curious about those three points that are really high in AI. But at low cost. So those guys have some magic. Is that
if it is magic, this journal is magic for all those that are interested in physics, so here it is. It's one of the best journals in physics. Living Reviews and Relativity, one of the top journals that's owned by the society. And they provide it for you. See if you get accepted. That's an unusual point. But as you see, there's a lot of zero cost, a lot of time. That's the funding is provided in other places. But you could put that journal up against any journal, for-profit, non-profit, open access, non-access, any of that, and it's one of the top journals. So it's kind of an anomaly, but it really says, this is one example. There was another question over here that I was going to ask. Yep?
I was just looking at the different fields and the different groupings of fields that you have come up with. How did you come up with those fields? Are those the most common fields that show up in some sort of search? Like, I'm focused on climate research. Climate-related.
Good question. So there's two ways to do it. So some places that we go get the data, they'll provide their field discipline. But we actually kind of use our own category. We use the same categorization system. We look at the network, and then we say, based on the relationships, these are a group, and look, they're all physics journals. So for example, you can narrow it. So if I was a physicist, and I wanted to look at just physics, let's hit physics. It'll populate it, at least this area of physics, and it shows only those in this area of physics.
And you'll see that they're all physics sort of journals or material journals. But in the new site, we actually got an increase in the number. These are just open access. We went, I think, from, I can't remember exactly how many, but I think we added another 50% more journals. So if there's not your field, then what we're trying to do is just tell us, and that seed, that gives us a seed to go look for and get all those journals in that field that are open access. We want to do, actually, one thing I should note is we want to do this sort of thing for authors to some degree, and labs, because you get this sort of funding support, and you can also do it at the article level. But that, this is, there's other, it's a little more complicated. So, another question? And then I probably should
move on. I know we're probably ready to move on. Hopefully, there's a one-sentence answer to this. I'm sure you said this, but I don't lost track of how you're measuring article influence.
Yeah, so article influence is, when we go, IDFact for the first time, there were two main metrics that came out. One of them we call IDFact, which is this network-based measure, and one of them we call article influence. It's the same thing as article, as IDFact, it uses a network, but it's, it normalizes by the number of articles the journal has. Because if you just, you know, IDFact is, it gives you the full effect, but things like, some of the biochemistry journals, some are so huge that by normalizing article influence, it is a network measure, but it's normalized by the size.